First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
An anti-immigrant crackdown in Florida has a range of groups sounding the alarm. Good morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a look at the push to punish those who would transport the undocumented in the state. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, we'll tell you how you can celebrate National Library Week this week and some other Wednesday good news. That and more coming up this Wednesday morning. But first, this hour, backlash is growing against a bill moving in the Florida legislature right now. Now, this measure would make it a felony to transport people who may be in this country without legal status. The bill is part of an immigrant crackdown by the governor and lawmakers. But the transportation provision has religious leaders, healthcare advocates, and others worried about the consequences. We're going to begin the hour with a closer look with two experts on the line, Andrea Reyes, immigration attorney and president of the Northeast Florida Immigrant Resource Alliance. Andrea, good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And here in studio, Jorge Bertrand of the St. Johns County Hispanic American Advisory Council and principal at the Cross Cultural Training Group. Jorge, good to see you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, too.
And we're talking about the anti-immigrant crackdown in Florida. What are your questions about this bill? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Facebook always open. Let's begin with Andrea. You're an immigration attorney. Tell us more about this bill. It would make it a third-degree felony for anyone who transports an undocumented person in Florida. Tell us about this.
So, yes, it would be it would make it a felony punishable up to 15 years to transport, conceal, shelter, or shield from detection any undocumented immigrants, whether the person knows it or should know that that person is undocumented. That is terrifying language. The definition of smuggling as it's presented in the bill is overbroad, and it really makes it really causes concern for the community because there are too many scenarios that would be considered smuggling under this bill. A church van transporting members to the church, a coworker giving an immigrant a ride, a wife taking their spouse or their child to work, which is entirely problematic due to the high number of mixed status homes that are in the state of Florida. Florida has over 500,000 of U.S. citizens that are living with at least one undocumented family member, and there are over 2 million U.S.-born citizens and residents of Florida with at least one immigrant parent. So the numbers there alone are baffling under this definition.
Hmm. Republican Latino state senators in Tallahassee are supporting this bill. A Latino Democrat, Senator Victor Torres of Kissimmee, voted against it. Supporters say this will combat the problem of human trafficking in Florida. At the same time, religious groups, evangelical Hispanic churches, and healthcare groups are opposing this for a number of reasons. Jorge Bertrand of the St. Johns County Hispanic American Advisory Council, you've been speaking to religious leaders in our area about this. What's their concern?
Well, their concern is basically about the transportation of undocumented aliens, also about the hospitals have to report mm-hmm. undocumented aliens that they're going to be attended at it, so they're very concerned. But like I was mentioning to you about this bill, it's no surprise. This bill, no surprise, because when DeSantis in his first election, when he went running for governor, he emphasized a lot E-Verify. Yes, he was very, very for it. That's why he was not the primary candidate. The establishment did not support him. Putnam was. Mm-hmm. He had the agriculture.
Yeah, he beat the agriculture commissioner, Adam Putnam.
Yeah, correctly. Yeah. So he was talking about that. But his idea of that at that time was that one area of attracting people was about the giving jobs to undocumented, and that without paying taxes and all this stuff. So it was undermining competition, etc., which is fine. Now, this is a completely different ball game here, in my opinion.
Why is that?
because of the transportation. Also, it would limit the free expression of religious. I mean, that's basically, it's against our First Amendment because, it's unconstitutional because it's hindering the ability of pastors to carry out the calling of the religious belief to care for anyone in need, and it's in violation of the religious freedom as stated in the First Amendment. Congress shall not law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise of it. So that's unconstitutional because as a religious person, you have to take care of the needy.
And evangelical Hispanic groups in Florida in particular have been lobbying against this bill. Healthcare organizations have as well. Andrea Reyes, what are the healthcare implications behind this measure?
So there's a couple. Number one is like the humanitarian aspect. Statistically speaking, immigrants barely seek medical attention as it is, and requiring hospitals to provide their immigration, requiring immigrants to provide their immigration status to hospitals when they're seeking medical care will ensure that they don't seek it any at all. It would actually require hospitals who are accepting Medicaid to collect and report immigration status data and submit a quarterly report to the Agency for Healthcare Administration on their individual responses, and then that agency would report it to the governor and to the legislature. There is the medical aspect of it where immigrants are not going to seek attention, whether they already don't. But, they will tell you that the intent of this bill is not to force people to be afraid of receiving care because they're supposed to say, well, that's not going to affect your ability to obtain medical attention. But this is absolutely going to cause people to be fearful. Like, that is a fact. And so even if this bill were to go to the federal courts and they successfully overturned it, at the end of the day, the chilling effect, the rhetoric of this bill is going to cause, it's going to create a lot of damage to immigrant communities. And considering that Florida's population is, we're the third or fourth largest immigrant populated state in the United States, it's going to have a smokeout effect on immigrants in the state of Florida.
A smokeout effect. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, so number one, we're not going to have a lot of immigrants wanting to come to the state of Florida for any type of work. Florida has been traditionally a desired state to work because of agriculture, construction, tourism, hospitality, all the restaurants and all the different industries where they're heavily populated with immigration. So people are not going to want to come to the state of Florida. And number two, the ones that are here, and especially the ones that have mixed status families, like I shared before, they're going to want to leave because they're not going to feel safe. So at the end of the day, and this is what I think, I'm actually very shocked that more people are not talking about the long-term effect of this bill. Yes, its short-term goal is to smoke out immigrants in the state of Florida, but the long-term effect of this bill is Florida's economic suicide. The economic contribution of immigrants to the state of Florida is massive, and I just don't think enough people are talking about it. And unfortunately, it's too late. This bill is going to pass. We have, a Senate and House Republican supermajority, and they're going to pass. But we make up, the immigrants in the state of Florida make up almost a quarter of the population of the state of Florida. And we have a contributing spending power of over $107.3 billion. Almost 400,000 immigrants are entrepreneurs in the state of Florida. The share of the workers in the Florida labor force is 26.5%. Who's gonna take those jobs? Who's gonna do all those jobs that immigrants have been doing?
Let's go to your calls. What are your questions, folks, about this bill? 549-2937. Give us a call. David in Pontevedra. Hi, David.
Oh,
good
hi.
Morning.
Why did they change the term illegal alien to undocumented immigrant? Why did they do that?
That's something that actually happened in the culture quite some time ago. And I'm not an expert in immigration law or immigration nomenclature, but, Jorge, I think the idea was that calling someone an illegal alien was seen as a pejorative. That because if they didn't have legal status in this country, that they should not be described in such a pejorative way. I believe that was the thinking behind that. Yeah. But let me ask you, Jorge, and it's 549-2937. Here's a comment from Mary Jo on Facebook. This bill means all of these farmers who employ undocumented immigrants to pick our crops will no longer have workers. This could bankrupt the state. You wouldn't be able to pick up your workers and drive them to work or to a doctor's appointment. If you do that, you'll be charged with a felony. It isn't human trafficking. It's hindering someone from helping somebody who is undocumented. Ed in Fleming Island emails the show. He says, let's not forget the governor won a landslide election with the support of 58% of the state's Hispanic voters. He goes on to say, my family are legal immigrants who followed the rules and came here with the approval of the United States government. There is a big difference between someone whom you invite to enter your home and someone who sneaks in through your back door. Ed is a Cuban immigrant, I believe. So, Jorge, two arguments there, pro and con, your thoughts.
Well, basically, you have to realize, as someone who's an immigrant, my wife is from Korea. It took us 2 years to get her here. The immigration laws in the United States are completely, it's just very complicated. I have a very good friend, a Harvard graduate, who does that. He tells me it's even more complicated than the tax code.
Mm.
It's just huge. So you have legal presence, you have unlawful presence. A lot of these immigrants or undocumented citizens or illegals, however you want to call it, they're being catch and released. They have the papers. They're waiting for the court to be up here. Maybe they show up 10 years from now. But they do have those papers. So it's very, very difficult to put them all in the same box. Also, we have to realize that the biggest unlawful presence in the United States, specifically in Florida, are the ones who overstay their visas. And they're all in Florida. They're mostly Argentinians, Europeans, whites, and they're all white. So it's kind of a difficult to pinpoint one exact denomination for all of them.
But, you know, that he is right about that, Andrea. 42% or more of people in this country that fall into this category, they came in with a legal visa and they just stayed beyond the expiration date. So if you transport someone like that, will you be charged with a felony?
So right now, the way that the bill is written is for the individuals who cross the border without any encounter with immigration or customs. That's a term called EWI, enter without inspection. The problem with this, right, is that when you say undocumented immigrant, it's a complicated legal nuance because of the vast different statuses that apply. As you just pointed out, right, non-immigrants who overstayed their visa is undocumented. People who cross the border are undocumented. People who were detained and processed at the border and released are undocumented. People who are currently in immigration status but don't have their green card approved yet are, you know, potentially undocumented. People with no legal status but who are not accruing unlawful presence are undocumented. People with a work permit who have a social security and a driver's license but no permanent status are undocumented. There are so many different categories of undocumented immigrants. And so what this bill does, yes, it does specify that it's for individuals who cross the border without any encounter or any lawful status. But when you refer to the concept of undocumented immigrants, there's a vast majority, you know, there's a vast diversity of types of immigrants that fall. And so to have to engage in this conversation, I mean, one of the things that the law enforcement, the bill does for law enforcement, right, it's going to require law enforcement agencies to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement activities, you know, happening within their jurisdictions. I mean, we already have that in the state of Florida, but now it's going to make it absolutely mandatory. There's going to be no state, local government or state entity can stop law enforcement from sending information to ICE, right? And so you're going to have to go through the inquiry of, like, what level of undocumented immigrant are you?
Are you
going to open up the collateral, investigation?
People are tweeting the show saying that the employers will be given a pass on E-Verify compliance if they take a screenshot showing they couldn't access E-Verify within 3 days of an employee's start date. They say there's a double standard buried within this bill. We'll have to look at that. But Jorge Bertrand, go ahead.
Well, I have another point about transportation, and Attorney Reyes can jump on that. Florida state may not deny access to public education to any child residing in the state, including children who are not citizens and do not have immigration documentation. The Supreme Court made this clearly 40 years ago in the Plyer versus Doe ruling. Now, undocumented children together with other children in Florida transported in to their schools by the district school buses. So what's going to happen?
If you're a bus driver and you unknowingly transport undocumented kids, are you going to be charged
with a
felony?
That's a point I've been bringing up. Because so what am I going to do? The school district transportation director is going to be charged. The bus driver is going to be charged. I have a meeting now with a law enforcement of my county because they're very worried about this. I'm talking to education people. You know, what about the yellow buses? Are you going to be stopping the yellow buses now and getting out of the brown kids out of the bus?
People are also asking us to point out that the governor himself transported or arranged to send planes to Texas to transport migrants to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. Religious groups helped them. Many of them were asylum seekers. Under this kind of measure, they would be charged with a felony. And so let's go to some calls now. Jennifer in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Hi, yes. My first question was about the school bus drivers. Are they going to be the document police? And what a traumatic thing for those poor children. And then second, the ambulance drivers. Are they document police? And are we going to deny the humanitarian service of transporting sick people? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Andrea Reyes, so many implications that callers and listeners are pointing out to this kind of legislation. You're criticizing this as overly broad precisely because of all of these consequences that could flow if this measure becomes law.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the biggest, whether you know it or should know that that person is undocumented, I think is a massive, overbroad definition of smuggling, because as was pointed out, you're going to have government agencies, state agencies, local agencies transporting undocumented immigrants. What about the local, transportation system for the cities? A lot of undocumented immigrants ride the buses. What are they going to do? Are they going to be the ICE police also? And so the bill itself is not very detailed. It does define, enter without inspection as like the target undocumented immigrant. But how are agencies who inherently transport and work with and employ immigrants who are undocumented, how are they going to document this, justify it, report it to the police? Like it says, it doesn't. It's a bill that was written, and again, I think very personally, I think it was designed to instill a lot of fear. It's a fear-mongering bill. It's motivated by all the wrong things, and this does nothing to fix the border crisis. This does absolutely nothing to fix the border crisis. So I just think it's a very intentionally fear-mongered bill to create a rhetoric and to create the legalization of hate and racism for immigrants in the state of Florida, along with, people of color and trans people and all these other bills that are getting passed.
And of course, Florida isn't a border state. That said, immigration is a potent issue in this state. Here is a comment from Debbie on Facebook. I agree we need immigrants and migrant workers, but they need to come in legally. The government has allowed millions of immigrants into our country illegally with no way to process them all. So, Jorge, as I mentioned, Florida is not a border state, but this is a divisive issue here for a number of reasons. And I know you have some thoughts.
Well, it's a border state because you have the ocean and a huge amount of Haitians, Cubans. I mean, I'm Cuban on descent and huge amount. I mean, from the Mariel, my family came during the Mariel, part of them.
The Mariel boat lift.
Yeah, the Mariel boat lift. A lot of those, so we have a border area issue, so specifically the Coast Guard. I understand mostly a lot of the pastors I've spoken with, they have a big, big issue on the transportation. They don't have that big issue on the part of the work to control the hiring of non-documented at below wages, not paying labor taxes. I had a lot of experiences. I work with migrant children. Last year I was called because they had a traffic accident and I had to translate, work that out, and I took them to their where they were working. This was a 16-year-old who was driving without a license with a 14-year-old. I took him to a construction. They were working on roofs. A 14-year-old should not be working
it's
in
child
a
child labor, yeah.
He should be in school.
Right.
So let's, and I, and a lot of the pastors agree on that, okay? The illegal hiring of undocumented children is a problem. And that was happening in St. John's County.
Let's go to more calls as we talk about the anti-immigrant crackdown in Tallahassee. There will be a rally, by the way, Saturday, one of six taking place across the state against this bill. The Jacksonville rally is set for 11 a.m. in Memorial Park in Riverside. Let us know your thoughts. 549-2937. Walt in Mandarin. Walt, good morning. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep, go right ahead.
My question is, if I read a little bit about this yesterday while I was in a doctor's appointment, and it's so broad that my question is, if a business who serves the public serves a person who is undocumented related to their legal status, would that business be on the line? In other words, if they walked into a Publix and say, I want to buy groceries, with immigration or whoever's going to enforce this come in and cite Publix and put the manager of the place in jail?
Thanks for that. Andrea Reyes, what about his question?
Yeah, so the smuggling makes it so that it's transport, conceal, shelter, or shield from detection. So I think that's why Jorge is talking about the transportation being like the biggest concern. I don't believe that serving an undocumented immigrant would make the business subject to criminal prosecution, no.
Let me ask you both. You both are characterizing this bill as overly broad and not really solving the core issue in the state and harming vulnerable communities. And it's certain to be challenged legally, as so many other controversial bills have in the DeSantis administration timeline. What, in your view, would do a better job of dealing with human trafficking issues and other issues that have made this a problem, not just in Florida, but in other states as well? What are your thoughts, Jorge?
Well, let's be honest about it. Even in during the Trump administration, I think it was in Texas, it was Pilgrim Factory Chickens. They did a raid over there. There were a lot of undocumented children working. The undocumented persons were criminalized. Not one manager, no one did anything. And I think I've told you that before. I have a longtime operative in Florida once told me that Democrats may love the votes, but Republicans love the cheap labor. And it's a reality. Business has never been
held accountable
and accountable for hiring. And it's illegal. I mean, they're not paying Social Security.
The workers are penalized, not the business owners.
I worked in Europe many years. They go after. They criminalize the employer. They don't criminalize the immigrant. Because those are the ones who are not paying the taxes. They're the ones who are taking advantage of these folks. And then all the minorities cannot get their jobs because they prefer to pay half the salary to someone than to pay real wages.
Andrea Reyes, would it make more sense to penalize those who are hiring the undocumented and then not providing protections for them when they get caught up in the legal system?
It's such a complicated issue. I mean, if you think about the last time we had immigration reform that created penalties for employers was in 1996. That was when we, you know, the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act, that was 27 years ago, was the last time we had any type of immigration reform that created penalties for both, you know, individuals who, undocumented immigrants who cross the border illegally and for employers. But again, as Jorge pointed out, employers have traditionally never been penalized. And so this bill would create penalty for employers, But what is shocking about this bill is that what is the backup plan? What is the how are we going to compensate for the lack of documented workers that we're going to have? How is the state of Florida going to fill the requirements of the crop industry, the hospitality industries, the all the different industries that, you know, are run by, you know, has a high share of immigrant workers, the cleaning industry, nail salons,
landscapers, so many industries. Right.
Who's going to feel that?
Yeah. I don't think people realize so that in so many aspects of their daily lives, the standard of living they enjoy in Florida is driven so often by the work of undocumented people in this state, whether it's the fruit and vegetables you eat at the store, your stay at a hotel, the landscapers working in your gated community, you name it.
No, you're right, but Attorney Reyes, one point I want to bring about that, because initially I spoke with a lot of big farmers in the state of Florida and landscapers. You have, I think it's the H-7 visa or something like that to bring in the immigrant workers. As a matter of fact, I was talking to a couple of them last week, and they're here through that visa. But the issue is it's expensive for the employer to do it legally. So if you have an opportunity to, you know, I mean, shortcut, they're not going to do it. So I think that visa, that H, correct me how you call it, I think H-7 or something.
It's called the H-2A, the Temporary Agriculture Program.
Correctly.
Alrighty.
That's very complicated.
And we're almost out of time, but we should note the ACLU of Florida has issued a statement to WJCT News blasting the bill. They say would criminalize Floridians who travel into the state with immigrants pursuing lawful status, including even those who are legally authorized to be here during the process. They say lawmakers should be focusing on public education, affordable housing, healthcare access, and job creation instead of harming immigrant families and the people and groups that interact with them. Andrea Reyes, your final thoughts, as this is most certainly going to face a legal challenge.
I would encourage us as a whole to change the narrative of immigration as a humanitarian issue and talk about it like what it really is, an economic one. I don't think we do this enough, and unfortunately now for the state of Florida, it's too late. And I think if we change the narrative from a humanitarian crisis to an economic one, people will understand that traditionally immigration has been a Republican-supported notion because of its economic impact. Immigration is good for the economy. Immigration is good for families. It's good for society if done the right way. But at the end of the day, the state of Florida alone is not going to handle this. This has to be a congressional issue. This has to be resolved by Congress. Congress needs to roll up their sleeves and get to work on immigration reform.
Thank you both for joining us. Immigration attorney Andrea Reyes of the Northeast Florida Immigrant Resource Alliance and Jorge Bertrand of the St. Johns County Hispanic American Advisory Council and the principal at the Cross Cultural Training Group. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, much more still ahead later. A little good news for your Wednesday to perk you up. But up next,
it's very challenging times for libraries. And this is why we would love people to use their public library.
In an era of book bans and threats to close their doors altogether, we'll tell you what you can do to support public libraries. It's National Library Week. That's next. Well, it dates back to 1958. That's when National Library Week began. It's celebrated each April, and it's a chance to celebrate and support a precious resource, your public library. This year, National Library Week is more important than ever, in a time when book bans and challenges to library funding are ramping up. For more, I spoke with Chris Bovin, Assistant Director of Community Relations with the Jacksonville Public Library. Take a listen. Hey, Chris, good to talk to you about libraries. Thanks for joining
Thanks.
Us.
Thanks, Melissa.
Okay, so it is National Library Week. How is that being observed here in North Florida?
Yeah, so National Library Week, what we are doing is we're doing a couple of fun things on social media. We're doing a few things in email. So what we've done is we've had our staff put together some photos, because National Library Week is all about celebrating libraries. There's a lot to celebrate library staff. So we'd love people to go check out our social media, vote for which staff pictures they like the best. Whichever ones get the most votes are going to win some great prizes. So that's one way that we're doing. And the other things that we're doing is we are providing all kinds of great service. We have a lot of great things that people can come in and get help from their friendly librarians. And we'd love to see people interact with the staff. And we just love to hear the comments and feedback from everybody. And we've been getting some wonderful feedback.
I think people are realizing just what a valuable resource our public libraries are, particularly in these times when books are being challenged and banned and removed from shelves. And even in other states, there are moves to defund public libraries, to get rid of them altogether. What about that?
Yeah, it's very challenging times for libraries. I mean, certainly in our area, the school libraries are experiencing the hardest challenges now with everything fighting against them. And yes, we've also been following the thought to defund. And this is why we would love people to use their public library. The more people use it, the more that becomes recognized as a valuable resource to the city. And if it's not something that you can use, you can contribute, you can volunteer, you can advocate. And we'll have some things coming up later this week where we'll be helping people find ways to advocate for their library. So, yeah, it's a very difficult time. Fortunately, at the library, we are all about making sure that everybody has access to materials. And so we want people to mm-hmm. come in and enjoy everything we have.
Yeah, just come visit your library branch. And Thursday is actually Take Action for Libraries Day, a day to rally people to support their public libraries. How can people be part of that?
Yeah, so what we'd love people to do on that day is to contact their elected officials, let them know how important their libraries are to them. We'll be trying to get some messages together that people can share, so it'll make it easy for people. So again, follow us on social media. If you're already a library card holder and we have your email address, we'll be getting some email out. But, you know, tell your elected officials that you value your public library, that your public library is important to your community. And that will go a long way in making sure that when those times come for them to make decisions about how to fund and support libraries, it goes a really long way when the citizens are actually reaching out and saying how important that is to them.
And I love the theme this year for National Library Week. The theme is there's more to the story. In other words, libraries have a lot more than books. At the main library downtown, you actually have a memory lab now where people can come and digitize their photos and videos for free.
Yeah, we're always having new ways to help people preserve their memories and preserve information. And yeah, you might see services out there that offer this, but if you have the time, come on down to the library. All it takes is your time. You can digitize the things that you have. You can take those digital copies with you, and that way you'll have you'll be able to get rid of some of this older media that deteriorates over time, like VHS, and even we've gotten old film strips. And we've had seen some really wonderful things, photos also. We see some wonderful things. We're able to add things to the collection. And it's something that, like you said, people can just come in, do this for free. And it's really been a gangbuster service. People just love it.
Yeah, check that out, the free memory lab at the downtown main library. And Chris, you have some great authors coming up to speak at various library branches in May and June as well.
Yeah, we are really happy with, we're getting some absolutely fantastic authors. If you haven't been to an author talk, we call them Lit Chats at the library, please do. We have on May 6th at the main library, we actually have Dr. Wayne Wood, very, very popular local historian. Now, this one, actually, I do have to say, this one is full in the physical library, but don't forget, you can also attend many of these events, this one included, virtually. So you can come and sign up, and you can watch this whole thing on Zoom. So that's 2 p.m. May 6th at the main library, or on Zoom. May 17th, we have Chef Dennis Chan of Blue Bamboo. He always provides a wonderful talk. It'll be a lot of fun. That's at 3 p.m. at the Beaches Branch Library on May 17th. And then we're just so overjoyed that we have Susan Orlean, author of The Orchid Thief and the library book. Susan will be coming to the main library on June 2nd. And so please go to the website, jackspubliclibrary.org. You can get all the information. You can register for any of these events, and registration always free.
Check it out, folks, and celebrate National Library Week. Chris Boven with the Jacks Public Library. Thanks.
Thanks, Melissa.
Well, mark your calendars for next week's TED event in downtown Jacksonville at the Jesse. It's your chance to watch a broadcast of the TED 2023 conference, be part of Art Walk, and learn more about TEDx Jacksonville. With more, we welcome Gene Grimsley, executive producer and organizer at TEDx Jax, and Mark Walker, senior program officer at the Jesse Baldupont Center. Good to have you both.
Thank you for having us.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Good to see you. Let's begin with you, Gene. This is a broadcast you're hosting at the Jesse. We can watch the national, or really the international, TED conference that happened last month.
Exactly. Many people are familiar with TED Talks, but very few people have the opportunity to go to the TED conference. And so here at our broadcast, you'll be sitting in the audience as the audience in Vancouver was doing, watching as the opening session unfolds with some really extraordinary innovative talks, as well as conversations between the host and the speakers.
So it's as though you were there.
Exactly.
Who are some of the big speakers that people will be able to see?
Jennifer Doudna, who is the biochemist who won the Nobel Prize for her contributions to the CRISPR editing. Tom Graham, who is a co-founder of Metaphysic, a company that creates Hollywood quality deep fakes, well known for the deep Tom Cruise fake.
Oh, interesting.
There's a bioacoustic specialist who is doing extraordinary things in interspecies communication using AI and microphones to listen in on the conversations that non-human species are having. It's truly Big TED, big ideas, extraordinary innovation, and really creative music performances as well.
Now, this is coming up on a night when people can also enjoy Art Walk and go to the Jesse Baldupont Center. Mark Walker, one of the nicest places around to go see an event. This is the second year you've partnered with TEDx Jax to present some programming. Tell us about that.
Sure. The Jesse, as you know, or may not know, we're home to 27 local nonprofits. But as a space, we also connect engaged citizens together in dialogue. And we want to help move that thinking towards community action. Our public programming at the Jesse all happens under the Jack's Next 100 umbrella. And that focuses on how we are wanting to make Jacksonville the best city it can be for all its residents in the next 100 years or less. Mm-hmm. To us, TEDx is a natural partner in that work. We'd love to have all the TEDx Jacksonville events at the Jesse, but we don't have enough space to fit their growing crowds. But the biannual TEDx Salon Series at the Jesse presents an opportunity to convene more intimate conversations about issues facing our community, like affordable housing, or in this case, bigger topics. And the participants in it can interact in ways that are more intimate and not possible at a larger TEDx event.
Nice. And of course, if people come out for this, Gene, they can learn a little bit more about TEDx, because you have opened up applications for speakers for the local conference in October, which we're going to host right here at WJCT.
We're very excited about that. Applications are open until June the 30th. It's a very competitive process, but we're looking for big ideas that are of meaning and import to our community that can be shared on not just our local, but even a global stage.
So all ideas welcome.
All ideas welcome, as long as they are fresh perspectives on existing problems or innovative takes on new technology.
And let's explain for people who aren't familiar, that's what TED Talks are all about. It stands for, let me remember, it's tech.
Technology, entertainment.
Entertainment and design.
Exactly, exactly.
But it really goes beyond those three.
It really
buckets.
Does. And if you come to our event May 3rd at the Jesse, you'll have a window into just how eclectic and different the ideas that are presented at a TED event are.
What are some of the biggest TED Talks that you would say maybe they've changed the world? They've shifted a paradigm somehow.
Oh my gosh, there's almost too many. Mr. Stevenson, who did this extraordinary talk on racial justice, who's gone on to found a museum of lynching in the South. He's an extraordinary speaker, but literally there's too many to name. And it isn't even just the ones that change the world. It's a talk that changes one person's world.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Mark, tell us a little bit more about Downtown Vision's First Wednesday Art Walk, because the Jesse is one of three Art Walk hubs and you like to have people stop by during Art Walk.
Yeah. I mean, it's a new thing since, Art Walk, like many things during the pandemic, it closed down. And so it resumed in October of 2021 and moved to this hub model. Mm-hmm. And we are one of those three hubs. And at those hubs, every month, you're going to see something new. At the Jesse, either before or after the TEDx event, for example, this month, you can see a live band on the corner gallery porch. Mm-hmm. You can come into the corner gallery and see the Veil of Maya and interact with the artist. We usually have performers, usually young people that are doing dances and other things inside the Jesse, vendors outside, a DJ, you can dance. Do double Dutch jump rope in the alleyway and enjoy food from food trucks.
So I feel like I'm in fourth grade again.
Yeah, it's fun. it's really fun. And, and this is, at the other two hubs are doing all kinds of other stuff. And the best part is, if you come back every month on the first Wednesday, the vibe is the same. You're this welcoming vibe. But we have a whole new group of family friendly musicians, food and activities for you to enjoy. And, I just want to mention Art Walk is not the only activity we do at the Jesse. We have regular public events. So if you follow us on whatever your preferred social media platform is, at the Jesse Jacks is what we are on every platform. You can stay up to date with those activities. And one of those is our next alleyway concert series we're doing with Winterland Presents on May 26th. And actually, WJCT Jacksonville Music Experience is part of that too. And it's featuring Acid Mother's Temple. So it's free. It's open to the public. We hope to see you there.
Yeah, come out for that.
Yeah.
And go to TEDxJacksonville.com. Get your tickets now for the broadcast of the TED 2023 conference Possibility. This is Wednesday, May 3rd, 6 p.m. at the Jesse in downtown Jacksonville. Thank you, Gene Grimsley, TEDx Jacks, Mark Walker at the Jesse. Sure to be a fun night downtown. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Again, that's Wednesday, May 3rd. And in a moment, how you can enjoy dining out for life this week and some other good news. We'll be right back.
The Jacksonville Today newsletter delivers all the local news you need in a 5-minute read to your inbox every weekday morning. With events and ways to get involved, little bits of joy to brighten your day, plus facts about Jack's history, and more. 15,000 of your neighbors are already reading. Find out why. Sign up at jackstoday.org/signup. That's jaxtoday.org/signup.
Next time on The World, the struggle over Sudan. Foreign nationals are rushing to get out. Some Sudanese have already left.
We don't think we'll be able to go back to Khartoum anytime soon.
Their country is on the verge of civil war.
I mean, I'd love to go back tomorrow if I could, but I can't.
The latest from Sudan and the rest of the day's news, it's on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, how everything from the place where you buy your coffee and donut to your child's pre-K learning center, your loved one's nursing home, and your ER may be owned or overseen by private equity firms, PEFs. We'll talk with financial reporter Gretchen Morgenson. Her new book is about PEFs, which she describes as plunderers. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
It's not the first time America's popular and profitable conservative media machine has thrown one of its stars overboard. But on the right, Tucker Carlson was the loudest voice in the room. His cable TV show shaped policy and much of the GOP's political weather. What will his sudden departure mean for the future of Fox and the Republican Party? Join us for that conversation next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the 18th annual Dining Out for Life happens tomorrow in Jacksonville. Just go out to lunch or dinner at a local hotspot, one of the participating restaurants, and a good chunk of your tab will help fund HIV and AIDS support and prevention here on the First Coast. I got the delicious details from Stephen Jones of the Northeast Florida AIDS Network and Ambassador Don Lopez of Action News Jax. Out for Life.
Yeah, this is our 18th annual Dining Out for Life here in Jacksonville, and 15 restaurants this year. Check out the participating restaurant list on our website, infanjax.org or diningoutforlife.com. It's got a link to each restaurant, but all day long, that one day, the restaurants will give 25% or more of your meal to InFan. And so some donate alcohol too, some don't. So please check the list if that's something you want to do.
Yeah, some of these restaurants are even donating 50% of your tab to the Northeast Florida AIDS Network. Don Lopez, yes. Action News, you and your colleagues have supported this event for years. Why is it important to you?
It is very important. We are a part of this community, too, and I was born and raised here. We've all been touched by HIV and AIDS. At this point, we all know someone, you work with someone, you have a family member. It touches all of our lives, and it's important for us all to be involved. Now, this is something that even my twins, I bring them out, and we participate. We've participated with Derek Odom in the past at work, at home, and I enjoy even bringing my kids out, and when we participate, we sit around the table and we discuss being compassionate people. We discuss how to be a part of our community. We discuss how being a part of Dining Out for Life is going to help make it easier for those who are in a fight and how we can help make life easier for them. So it's important for us, and it should be important for us all.
And it's also an easy way you can do it, Stephen. Just go out to eat on the date, April 27th, everybody from Carmine's Pie House to BB's, Bellwether, Biscotti's, and Black Sheep, to Orsay, a very fancy restaurant, Tolua Bistro at the Beaches. They will all be donating to your organization. Can you tell us a little bit more about how the money will be used to help people with HIV and AIDS?
The proceeds mainly will go to support our food pantry at InFan, pantry for HIV-positive folks and their families. We service the five counties of Northeast Florida, so this really helps support that.
No longer a death sentence. There are correct medications now where people can live with this disease. So, Don Lopez, there's going to be a $1,000 Visa gift card, raffle grand prize with this year's Dining Out for Life. Lots of good stuff. And where will you be eating on April 27th?
I tell you, I'm still deciding. Last year it was Biscotti's, and my family and I, we did lunch and we did dinner. And keep in mind, too, that you can have your meal delivered as well. that's important to know. You mm-hmm. can even, I have some friends, one in particular, she just had surgery. I would love to send lunch on over to her, and it's kind of a twofer to let her know that it's a special gift in honor of, and then she can have lunch too. So that's a way that you can give. I'm trying to be creative here, as well as my twins. They are looking forward to this. So they are studying the menus very, very carefully to decide what we're going to have for dinner and where we would like to go. But I would also encourage families, if you have teenagers who need to get those community service hours in, you can also volunteer your time.
So check it out. Pick a restaurant for tomorrow for Dining Out for Life. Go to nfanjax.org. Well, the ARC Jacksonville and FSCJ are launching a first-of-its-kind program for students. 15 students with intellectual and developmental differences will begin a vocational program and get a certificate from FSCJ and a path to gainful employment. Check that out. Career paths include childcare, welding, digital media, nursing, and much more. Independent Bookstore Day is Saturday. Check out the Bookmark in Neptune Beach for festivities. Maybe go to San Marco Books and More. Buy a book. Shop local. It's Independent Bookstore Day this Saturday, all day long. Shout out to the new Pillars Plus Foundation, working with foster care young adults aging out of the system. Without enough mentorship and preparation, many young adults aging out can struggle. Pillars Plus is holding its first event Saturday, a hymn sing for all choirs, praise bands, and anyone who has the talent to share. And finally, check out the artwork of artist Ash Wolfdog Hainer, exhibiting now at the Hotel Palms in Atlantic Beach. This is Hainer's second residency at the Hotel Palms. His solo exhibition is titled Tranquility. We could all use a little bit of that. If you've got a tasty item you'd like us to add to our weekly Wednesday menu of good news, just drop us a line at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And thanks, everybody. Thanks also to David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Isabella Da Silva, Michelle Corum, our intern Kathy Waterman answering phones today. Theme music composed and performed by Club de Belugas. And I'm Melissa Ross. This is WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville. Make it a great Wednesday. We'll catch you tomorrow morning.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.